Blog Talk Radio. At the National Archives and Beyond, Blog Talk Radio. This is your guest host, Natan Elaine Kemp. I want to welcome our callers and chatters to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. This show will provide individuals interested in genealogy an opportunity to listen, learn, and take action. You can join this show every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and 8 p.m. Central, where Bernice Alexander Bennett will have a wonderful lineup of experts who will share resources, stories, and answer your burning genealogy questions. All of the guests share a deep passion and knowledge of genealogy and history. If you have logged in as a guest and wish to participate in the chat, you can sign in through your Facebook account or Blog Talk Radio. I will also open the lines in the second half of the show so that you can ask questions of the guest. A few months ago, Benny J. McRae discussed a chronology, Blacks in the Civil War, providing details about the roles individuals of African descent played in the Civil War. And more than a year ago, you may recall Harry Jones, the assistant director and curator of the Washington, D.C.-based African American Civil War Freedom Foundation and Museum, discussing the Glorious March to Liberty, The Untold Story. Tonight's guest insight into another facet of the Civil War, a topic which has not received much attention, Black prisoners and Confederate prisoners during the Civil War. Bob J. O'Connor is a native of Dixon, Illinois, and a graduate of Northern Illinois University. He is retired and lives in Charlestown, West Virginia, and is the author of 9 books, all on the American Civil War. His topics include John Brown, abolitionist, Warhill Lemon, President Lincoln's bodyguard, and Civil War topics linked to his local area, two brothers who fought against each other twice, and a blacksmith who is seeking his freedom. Bob O'Connor's interest in studying African-American history comes from studying John Brown and Abraham Lincoln and their concerns with slavery. Bob O'Connor's current research involves studying the black prisoners held in Confederate prisons during the Civil War. The stereotypes that no black prisoner made it to prison are wrong. In fact, he is only partially through the U.S. Colored Troops records and has found 2,182 black prisoners, 2,078 soldiers, and 104 black sailors. An amazing 79% of those black POWs survived their incarceration. Bob O'Connor's research includes the names, regiments, company, rank, date of capture, place of capture, name of the prison or prisons where they were held, if they survived or not, date of death or what happened to them, place of birth, and age. Let me give a warm welcome to Bob J. O'Connor to Research at the National Archives and Beyond. Welcome. Mr. O'Connor, are you there?
Thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
Well, I'm glad you have joined us, and I'm going to let everyone know that we have a special guest host for tonight's show. I'm going to try to get in touch with her again. That's Angela Walton Raji. Mr. O'Connor, could you give us some more background about yourself as I connect Angela to the show?
Sure. My interest in this topic comes from a book that I wrote that was historical fiction called Cats Be Eyewitness to the Civil War. Cats Be lived in the local area where I live near Charlestown, West Virginia, and he was a slave to Louis Washington, the great grandnephew of George Washington. And
I apologize.
Hello.
We're trying to get Angela on. Angela?
Okay.
I'm here.
Angela, great. I'm going to turn the show over to you.
Oh, okay, great. Well, hello, Bob O'Connor. Good evening to you.
Thank you. I was just starting to explain how I got involved in this project, and glad to have you along.
Absolutely. Well, I'm a bit familiar with your work, and why don't you share with our listeners how you became interested in the U.S. Colored Troops and particularly the prisoners of war?
Okay. As I started to say, I wrote a book called Cats Be Eyewitness to the Civil War. Cats Be was a slave to Louis Washington, a real slave that lived in Charlestown, West Virginia, where I live, when it was Virginia, and he was captured by John Brown. And I followed him through the Civil War from his journals and from letters that he left. And he was captured in Florida when he was a blacksmith for the 54th Massachusetts. And that was in February of 1864, and he was sent to Andersonville Prison. And he was he had a bad leg, and so they couldn't get any work out of him. So they asked him, because he could read and write, to keep track of the African-American prisoners in the prison. So when I wrote that book, I listed all the black prisoners that were in there, their ranks and their regiments and everything. And when I sent the book to Andersonville Prison to see if they would sell it, they wanted to know if I had made up the names, since it was a fictional book, or if they were real names, because they didn't have any idea how many black prisoners they had. And I told them no, they were real names. And so with their encouragement, I wrote a book called The U.S. Colored Troops at Andersonville Prison, and I identified 105 soldiers that had been captured and been held at that prison. And then as I went further, I had read there were 776 black prisoner total in Confederate prisons. That was what historians had been saying. And I thought, well, I have 105 already. I'll just go find the rest of them. If it would have been 50,000, I probably wouldn't have looked. But since it was only 670 more, I thought, well, I'll go see if I can find them. And I surpassed that number long ago, and was quite surprised myself to find that I've found, even though my research is still ongoing, I've found over 2,100 men that were in Confederate prisons and their status and where they were captured and everything, and I have a database now that I'm working on. So that's kind of the shortened version of how I got there.
What an amazing story. With that amount, I'm just really curious, scattered among how many different prisons were these 2,100 black soldiers imprisoned? How many different places have you identified where they were held as prisoners?
Well, there were actually 32 Confederate prisons, and not all of the records show what prison they were held in, but I have significant numbers. For instance, I had already said Andersonville had over 100. Salisbury, North Carolina had a very large Confederate prison. Their records indicate that they may have had as many as 500. I've come up with 173 names from there. Some prisons were small and had small amounts. I've identified 13 that were in Florence Prison in South Carolina. I have over 1,000 that I think were in Cahaba Prison in near Mobile, Alabama. And so, you know, just various places. A lot of them started in Richmond. There were 15 Confederate prisons in Richmond, and then they were shipped out to other prisons. Some some were in as many as four or five different prisons as they were moved around at different times. As the prisons in Richmond got crowded, they built new prisons, and they would ship prisoners to different places. So some actually were incarcerated to four or five different places.
Oh, my goodness. Well, actually, you made me raise my eyebrows when you mentioned, I guess, is it the Cahaba prison in Mobile? And I ask that because I have ancestors who were captured as prisoners, but theirs is a unique story. And people who've heard me talk about my Uncle Cephas know who I'm referring to, Cephas Bass.
Right.
But with the 111th
right.
U.S. Colored Infantry, they were
right.
captured along with the for Alabama.
Captured by Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Yes.
Right.
Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Right.
And what a surprise, because I was thinking, wow, this is, what, 6 months or so after the Fort Pillow massacre.
Right, and he's known for Fort Pillow, but he captured many more at Athens, Alabama, and at Sulphur Branch
yes.
Trestle than he did at Fort Pillow.
Absolutely, and that was where my ancestor was captured. Well, a question. I guess you've completely blown out of the water that old, I guess, this, assumption that many of us have been led to believe that there were no colored prisoners taken
right.
to prison.
Right.
And so you've completely blown that away. I guess I'm curious, how have historians received your work? Since you have completely uncovered this new knowledge in Civil War history.
Well, it's pretty hard to refute it because there's so many, and I have so much information on each one. And so it's pretty hard to refute. I'm getting mixed reviews because I'm having trouble getting people's attention that I even have the information. And it's not always 100% reliable, because like with your relative, the prisoners that were taken by Nathan Bedford Forrest, we're not sure they were even kept in a prison because they were made to work on the railroads down there. And he also published a list of them, about 600 of them, in the Mobile, Alabama newspaper, and asked their owner to come back and get them because he wanted to get rid of them. So I'm not even sure they were in prisons, but I know they were prisoners, but I don't know if they were in an actual prison.
They were confined, in other words.
Right.
Interesting. Well, can you tell us how the prisoners themselves were treated from what you have been able to study? How were they treated in comparison to white prisoners once they actually were physically there at Andersonville or other facilities as well?
Well, this is probably going to blow you away, too, because in many cases they needed the black prisoners to dig graves. They were physically able to do that, and it was probably something that they felt that was below the white prisoners doing, and it actually was an advantage because the black prisoners got to go outside the stench of the prison. They got food and water because they needed them to be capable of digging a grave, and they got exercise every day. So they actually were treated in such a way that it actually helped them probably survive, because instead of just sitting on the ground and wasting time, they were working. And to me, being physically fit was a tremendous advantage to you in a place that all it had was disease and sickly people and people that were dying.
Absolutely amazing. Have you been able to determine then any kind of survival rate as a result, since you did point out they were getting out, they were getting fresh air, they were getting exercise and maybe some minimum degree of nourishment because they were doing this physical
right.
labor?
Well, over 75% of the ones that I have tracked actually survived their stay in the prison. Which is a pretty amazing statistic in itself.
Absolutely incredible. That is surprising, particularly when one thinks of a place like Andersonville, and I guess
right.
that's one of the more famous prisons.
Right, and about 28% of them did not survive. So it was a pretty good number. But my theory to that is that I think that because a lot of these men had been former slaves, they had a rough life to begin with.
Yeah, that's true.
And they had
it's the hard labor in it.
Yeah, to begin with. And yet the white man was probably not seen rough times until he got into prison, and then it was too much for him. And so I think the fiber of the attitude and the well-being of the colored soldier, I think he was more able to accept the confinement as being, oh, this isn't any worse than some of the other things I've been through, you know. Therefore, I think that they survived on top of everything because of that too.
Very interesting. One of the things that I have noticed in the pension file, where my ancestor, for example, spoke about being captured at Sulphur Branch Trestle in North
right.
Alabama, and he pointed out the fact that this is an ancestor who enlisted in the 111th. He was really
right.
from Giles County, Tennessee, and he enlisted with a brother and with his two sons. So it's the four of them who enlisted together. And he pointed out that he was captured by Forrest. And for some reason, Forrest pulled him, his brother, and his two sons. The four of them were pulled apart from the rest of the soldiers as they were being moved. And he did mention they were being sent on to Mobile. But then he mentioned that Forrest pulled the four of them out separately, and I've often wondered why in the world would a general in an army care about four enlisted men, but then it dawned on me where they lived and where Bedford Forrest was from, which was Giles County. There was probably some recognition, because I know that there was this commitment on his part to return slaves back to their owners.
Right.
Well, it turns out, to shorten a long story, they escaped. The four of them escaped from him. This is documented also in their service record that they had escaped from
right.
confinement. And it's something that's interesting. So it's possible, as you mentioned, the soldiers sent to Mobile perhaps were really, because his commitment was to see that soldiers got returned, which is still better than what had happened at Fort Pillow, which
right,
is still
right.
amazing.
Well, and Forrest gives numbers of the men that he captured, and he captured probably 1,200 colored soldiers
uh-huh.
over a two-day
yes.
period. And
yes.
he talks about marching them, and then he says when he got there that there were only about 900. So a lot of them escaped, evidently, or there were just so many that they couldn't keep track of all of them. And he was
correct.
Surprised when he got to where his destination was that he didn't have as many that he started out with. So,
right. And my Uncle Cephas among them who had escaped.
There you go.
Well, I'm
good
curious,
for him.
Have you found that the USCTs, these colored troops, were any of them, from what you've been able to determine, exchanged or paroled early when they did reach their destination? Since you indicated there were some publications that maybe listed their names and their owners,
right.
did you find that there was that effort to truly have them exchanged or removed from confinement? What have you found?
I find the officers were exchanged, but I'm and they don't say. The officers don't have the sheet in there that shows their age and where they were born and everything and their race, because they enlisted somewhere else and they were transferred to the U.S. Colored Troops. So I'm thinking that most of the ones that got exchanged within 10 or 15 days were officers and they were white. Now some of the black prisoners got paroled along the way, and some of them didn't stay in prison very long. I have at least one that was that was paroled and got recaptured a second time and got put in prison, a different prison a second time. So it was just various ones, but some of them that were captured in early 63 didn't get out till the war was over, so they were incarcerated that whole time. So and that was probably the majority. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me as to you know, who was in the longest, but some served time in prison for you know, a little bit short of 2 years, which is a long time because they were bad places to be in.
Well, would you say then being imprisoned in a place such as Andersonville or other prisons as well, was that imprisonment somewhat of an anomaly? Or it seems as if some were really confined throughout the duration, which I guess many of us who've heard and read of Fort Pillow or Poison Springs in Arkansas sort of think that, oh, well, it was not a tendency to give any black soldiers, any colored soldiers, what is it, we'll give no colored soldiers any quarter. So, you know, this did happen in spite of what has been previously stated about black soldiers.
I would say that even if they were in a prison, they weren't in a very good place, because your chances of dying in a prison were greater than your chances of dying in a battle, and nobody was shooting at you because they weren't getting fed, and because disease was so rampant that it was just real difficult to survive in a prison. So that's why it's remarkable that 75% of them actually survived.
That is incredible. Well, as you've indicated, and I know I know that you've indicated, you know, in your book, some of the soldiers who died while there as well. Did you find that to be the case in some of the other prisons? Or have you studied the imprisonment as thoroughly as you have with the Andersonville soldiers?
Well, there's more at Andersonville because they actually have a graveyard and they have a lot of the records. There were 12,942 deaths in Andersonville, and they have all of the names except about 400, so they did a really good job of keeping the records. A lot of the other prisons, for instance, at Florence, South Carolina, their historian says that they didn't have any black soldiers there, and I said, well, I have the names of 13 that were there, and, you know, I'll give them to you. And the same at Salisbury. They had newspaper articles that said that black soldiers were transferred from Richmond to Salisbury, but they didn't have any names. So, again, the records are not very good. A lot of times when they came and closed down the prison, you know, the Confederates would burn the records before anybody got there, you know, to cover their, you know, behinds. And so I guess in some sense, it was easier to figure out Andersonville than it is going to be some of the other places. Like I say, when I look at the ones from Athens, Alabama, and Sulphur Branch, Trestle, they don't. I think out of the 1,100 or so soldiers, there was only one that said that he was actually in Cahaba Prison. Now I just assumed that was probably where they were, but I don't have that. On their record, it doesn't say what prison they're held in. A lot of each soldier has a POW card that tells you what prison they're held in, and these will tell you when they were captured and when they were released, but it doesn't tell you what prison they were held in. So I'm just trying to figure that out as I go along, and I'll go down to Alabama and I'll meet with them down there, and you know, I'll go to Florence, and you know, I've already been to Salisbury. I went to the prison conference there and spoke and delivered the 173 names that I have for them, because people that are looking for their ancestors in Salisbury are not going to call Bob O'Connor in West Virginia to find out if I have information.
Right.
They're going to go to Salisbury. So I wanted them to have the information where the people were most likely to look for it. So that's you know, part of what I'm doing is delivering to the places that where the prisons were held, the information as I gather it.
That is so amazing. Well, do you have any indication, and I do know from reading accounts of Nathan Bedford Forrest that he did believe that the soldiers, more than anything else, of course, this is after he had gotten very, very bad publicity and all kinds of military sectors after the Fort Pillow massacre. Do you have any indication that any of the black soldiers captured were indeed sent back into enslavement? Were they sent back to their owners, as he particularly, I know, had wanted? Have you seen any evidence of that?
Yeah, absolutely. It even will say on some of the records that would say, for instance, that he was wounded and he was convalescing back at the plantation where he was a slave. Now, what does that tell you?
Oh,
you know, he was taken
and
home, so to speak, which is probably not the place that he would have wanted to be. But
in other
situations, it actually says return to his master. It says it right on the card. And in one instance, a soldier lived in Petersburg, Virginia. He escaped and joined the U.S. colored troops and was sent to fight at the Battle of Crater, and was captured at the Battle of Crater and sent to prison in Petersburg. And his master was a sutler who sold goods to the prison. And his master came in and says, "Robert, is that you?" And he said, "Yes, master." And he said, and they took him back home. So that was just a bad set of coincidences for the slave. And it's interesting because that happened. That wasn't supposed to happen, but it continued to happen. And I don't have huge numbers, but I have numbers that indicate that it very definitely took place. I also have indications that soldiers that were captured didn't make it to prison because they would march the white soldiers off in one direction, the black soldiers off to another direction, and the next day people would find 40 or 50 black soldiers dead in a ditch somewhere because they killed them.
And that's something that I remember, just even my own reaction when I read the this deposition from my own ancestor, and I'm thinking, N.B. Forrest captured you, and you lived?
Yeah.
Because, again, there was certainly a very strong sentiment that, yes, prisoners, but, you know, you're still a slave and you're still beneath that status to be treated as a prisoner of war.
In fact, some of the prisoner of war cards actually say, right on the card, it says, "This Negro man claims to be a U.S. soldier." Now, this was right at the beginning of the U.S. colored troops, and so the guy that was processing him in the prison didn't believe that he was a soldier. And it says, card after card after card after card, says that right on it down at the bottom, "This Negro man claims to be a U.S. soldier." So the guy that was processing him in wasn't even believing that this guy was a soldier. But he wrote it down because the guy told him this is a soldier. Yeah. So there were all kinds of things that were going on. And as I said, Forrest advertised in the newspaper the names of these that were captured, particularly around Giles County, and asked the master to come.
Okay, so that was the effort that he was making.
And historians to this day will tell you that there's almost 600 names in that newspaper article, and they'll say, "We don't know who any of these people are." And I'll tell you that I know more than half of them because I can match up their names to their master's last name, and most of them had the same name.
That is really incredible.
So if the guy's name was Painter and the slave was named, Zebulun. Well, and he's from Giles County. Well, there weren't too many Zebulun.
Right.
And I have a captive called Zebulun Painter. Well, that's got to be Mr. Painter's slave, Zebulun.
Right.
And so
I was able
to match those up.
Right. Yeah. Amazing.
I mean, if your name was John Smith and your owner's name was Smith, I have trouble figuring out which John Smith you were. But there were a lot of unusual first names, and so I can match them up, and nobody's ever been able to do that either.
Correct. Absolutely amazing. Yeah. Well, I tell you what, why don't we take a break and we'll come back and we'll also entertain any questions
okay.
in case there are. Well, okay?
I'll be here.
All right.
National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is Natan Elaine Kemp, and you are listening to our special guest host, Angela Walton-Raji, and our guest tonight, Bob J. O'Connor. I want to remind everyone that all of these shows are archived and available immediately after the broadcast as a podcast. If you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please call 646-200-0491 and press 1 to speak to the host. Angela?
Okay, thank you, Natan. I have a question, Bob,
okay.
in terms of where I guess one takes things at this point. I know, for example, the 111th and 110th U.S. Colored Troops were captured at Sulphur Branch Trestle in North Alabama. One who's maybe listening to this, perhaps who has ancestors in one of those two regiments, would it be wise for them, just going on some of the incredible gems that you're sharing, would it be perhaps wise to start to pull some of those pension records, relatives or not, but to really see what happened in a pattern? I'm just very curious if someone themselves wanted to take this up and take a closer look themselves. Where would you recommend that they go, and where are you right now with that process also?
Well, I use basically Fold 3, F-O-L-D, the number 3, which is a National Archives program. In fact, if you go to the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and ask for the U.S. Colored Troop records, they'll actually set you down at a computer and get you on Fold 3. They won't even let you look at their records because Fold 3's already got them all scanned into a computer. So I do that from home, and all of the U.S. Colored Troop records are now online, and you can go in by name or by regiment and look. What I have to do, because I don't have any names, I have to start with the 1st Regiment, file A, and go from Adam Adams to Zachary Zucchini and go through all 1,000 names. In each regiment. But if you know the name, you know, you have a shortcut. Or if you know the regiment, you have a shortcut. But
right.
Then I would say go on the National Archives website and get the files that they have. They charge you a fee, and it'll take them a month or so, but they'll mail them to you. You don't have to live near Washington, D.C. like I do to get that information. And then you can get the pension files or whatever records you're asking for. And a lot of those have, as you know, have personal letters in them, and you can get a lot more information than I'm getting. I'm just getting the POW card, and then I'm backtracking and trying to figure out, you know, where he was born, what his age is, what his regiment rank, and all that stuff. I can pull that up in the file. And there's a lot more files. You know, the stereotype is that there's no black history. Well, that's baloney. And, you know, most of the files that I look at probably have 20 or 25 pages in them. Some have as many as 300 pages in them. So there's no lack of information you know, sometimes you, if the name is spelled a little differently, you might have to look under several names because it's hard to read. Sometimes it's hard to read the spelling on the names, or the names will be similar and they'll be in separate files. So you may have part of a file on your relative in one place and part of it in another place. But you know, once you take a look at them and get the feel of it, it's not too difficult. It's just time consuming, and you know, I'm part way through the process, and I have to, you know, I keep going through. Now, eventually, my database will be online, and it'll be searchable. So you can search by name, or you can search by regiment, or you can search by prison, or you can search by where they were captured, or date of capture, or all of
that was my
eventually.
Next question, sort of, you know, where were you or where are you in that research, in terms of the availability of having access to that data? Would you say that you're sort of in the middle of it? Is it something that
I probably have 160,000 records finished, and I probably have 30,000 or 40,000 to go. So I'm well into it.
Okay.
And on the downhill slope for sure.
When you say 160,000 records, are you saying 160,000 individuals?
Right. Yeah. 160,000 individuals. I've been through most of the soldiers, and I have some of the soldiers to go, and I have all of the sailors to go. I've only had a little bit of information on the sailors. There's about 20,000 sailors.
I guess I'm curious, approximately 178,000 black soldiers in the Union Army and Navy. Are you saying that three quarters of them were imprisoned at some time or another?
No, I'm talking about 2,200 being in prison of the 179,000. 2,200.
Right.
But
I've
been through 160,000 records.
Find those 2,200.
Right. Yeah.
I see.
And
so
I
you are going one. Amazing.
I have most of the soldiers finished. I don't have very many of the sailors looked up yet.
Okay. That's an awesome task to undertake. And now, where are you as you look back? How many years has it been? About 3 years since you published the Andersonville book?
Yeah, that's correct.
About that time. Now, as you look back and you've acquired much more data since that time, are you planning to even expand that work on Andersonville? Because Andersonville has its own aura. You say
that means
you say the name of that place, and you know, people know what happened in Andersonville and just how horrific it was. Are you
found more prisoners than I had in my book, too, that were in Andersonville, or we think they were in Andersonville, and I'm trying to track that down. I actually have a helper that works in the prison history department down there, and his name's Kevin Fry, and he helped me with my original book, and he's helping me to make sure that the ones that we're looking at now, the new ones, you know, match up with the records that they have, because I want to make sure that I have double checked so that their record and my record has to agree in order for it to be added. So,
So does that mean a revision to your
book? Yeah, I'll add to the Andersonville book, and then I'll probably do a separate book with all of them. But the difficulty in that is that as soon as it comes out, and somebody like you calls me and said that I left out one of your four relatives, then I got it. You know,
right.
So I'm never going to be completely finished, and that's fine, because I would encourage people that if you have information on a prisoner, you know, check with me to see if I have him, and if I have him, I'll give you what I have on him, and you can give me what you have on him, and maybe I can expand, you know, my database in that regard, too. In fact, when I wrote my Andersonville book, as soon as it came out, a lady told me that she had she knew of two other prisoners in there, and so I added them. So, and I can do that because my books are in a computer, and I can I can just add pages to it. But it's gonna, and I know it's never gonna be done, and that's fine. I just want to keep adding when people say that they know something about another one, and I'll just, you know, keep adding to it. It's easier to add it online than it is in the published edition, but if somebody buys a published edition, what I'll do is I'll take their name, and when I get, you know, some more lists, I'll just ship them the list, and they can put them back in the back of their book. So,
absolutely amazing. Well, I'm curious, what has been the impact of this work that you have begun on you, on your life? I mean, I'm sure you didn't wake up one day 4 years ago and say, let me go and find some black soldiers at Andersonville. Obviously, this has to have certainly impacted your life in a certain way. Since you made that first discovery, what has happened, and what's been the impact of your work on your life?
Well, it has been interesting. My mother had asked me several times why I was interested in black history, because I'm a white man and I don't know of any blacks in my family, although I wouldn't be opposed to that in any way, shape, or form because of my studies and everything. And I tell people it's because of John Brown and because of Abraham Lincoln and my studies of those two men and my studies of slavery. And actually, it might be hard for people to believe, but every new person I find, I get excited about, and I want to find another one. And particularly when I went through the 110th and 111th that we've been talking about, those regiments, out of a thousand men in each one of those regiments, 2,000 men, there were over 600 that were captured. And of course, some regiments I can go through and there'll be none. So I'll go through a whole list of 1,000 men and I don't find any.
So when I
got to the 110th and 111th, it was like almost every one, you know, every other one or every third one was a prisoner. And it's like, oh my goodness. And I still get excited. I still get excited when I find somebody, because these are lost people. These are people that nobody knows are out there.
Nobody knows.
And why I was chosen for this task, I have no idea. But you get, you know, why am I the spokesman for this topic? I don't know. But I kind of feel honored to be able to do this in some strange way. I feel honored that it was me that I get to do this, and I know that other people have, you know, people helping them, and I'm doing this by myself, so I don't have to worry about whether my associates are looking there and saying, well, this guy might have been a prisoner, let's just throw him in to have another extra number. I don't do that. I have criteria, and if they don't pass the criteria, because they can have a POW card, and it'll say believed to be a prisoner of war, but if I can't find it, I don't put them in. So, you know, so it's just kind of interesting. And yeah, it's impacted my life, and it probably takes away from time that I should be writing my next historical novel. But this is okay.
Oh, that fears with a lot of us. You're not alone in that task.
Well, I am curious. You don't know why you're... You know, things happen. It just happens, I get great pleasure in speaking on the topic and informing people. And people just, a lot of people don't know they're even black soldiers. So to tell them they're black soldiers in prison is just even way beyond their imagination at all.
Right. Well, you and your process. Once upon a time, you found a black man who was in Andersonville. Do you recall the first soldier, or do you recall that moment when you began to realize, oh, my goodness, here's something that's not been written about before? Can you recall what?
Well, that would have been when I was working on the book, Cat's Be Eyewitness to the Civil War, and reading in his his papers that he was incarcerated there. And I didn't know that. I didn't know there were black soldiers there. But as I started, looking them up, there were over 100. Now, that's not a lot because there were 33,000 in that prison, but that's not a lot. But it was, I guess, more than I would have guessed. And then to find out that they were digging the graves and, that a lot of them survived, that was kind of interesting. And that there were white officers in that prison that should have been sent to an officer's prison, but because they were white officers of black soldiers, they were considered black soldiers. And so they were treated differently. And, they didn't get exchanged. They didn't get medical help if they were wounded because they were considered black. And so just a lot of things that I've learned that I've been able to pass on to people now. And I just gave a talk locally here in Charlestown for the 150th anniversary of the formation of the U.S. Colored Troops, which was May 22nd. And I talked about 12 U.S. Colored Soldiers that were from Jefferson County, Charlestown, West Virginia. And I tracked a couple of them, and I found their headstones, their graves, and I actually found a drawing of one of them. And then what I found out was really interesting, because I go to Olustee, Florida every year to do programs on the black soldiers at Olustee, Florida. And I found out that three of the local men that live in the same town that I lived in were in that battle, and two of them got wounded in that battle, and I didn't know that. And I go down there and talk about it every year, and I didn't even know they were there. So I learned stuff too.
Incredible. Well, would you say how far are you from at least completing the database, and are you weeks away, months away, a year away before things will be maybe researchable online, the database that you're working on?
It's probably, depending on how accessible the sailors are, it's probably going to be within the next year.
Okay. And that's absolutely amazing. And should any of our listeners out there want to get in contact with you, what is the best way for them to reach you?
The best way is email.
Okay. And what is your email, your preferred email?
Okay. It's author, A-U-T-H-O-R. BobO'ConnorBooks.com.
Okay.
Now I'll spell that, but all the vowels are O's. It's BOBOCONNORBOOKS.com. Author at BobO'ConnorBooks.com.
Okay, so Bob O'Connor, the O'Connor does not have the apostrophe. It's
no.
B-O-B-O-C-O-N-N-O-R.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Wonderful. Author at BobO'ConnorBooks.com.
Right.
Absolutely amazing work that you have done. Are there any questions or comments coming from the chat, Natan?
Yes, there are, Angela. There's been a lot of discussion about Andersonville. Bob, have you visited Andersonville?
Absolutely. I go there every year to do programs, and I've actually slept on the ground overnight, the freakiest experience I've ever had.
Wow. That's amazing.
Another question. Have you been in contact with any descendants of these black prisoners?
I've run across several people in the last year or so that have emailed me and said that they thought that they wanted to see if I had such and such a person on my list, and I either did or I didn't, and if I didn't, I added them, and I shared the information with them. And as I said, I go to the, I'm going to try to go to the different organizations, the history groups that are in these towns where these prisons were, and deliver that information to them so that they'll have it when people are looking. But I'm very open to helping people find a particular person or persons that they might be related to that might be on my list.
Great. A third question. I want to say that we have just under 9 minutes left of this show. And a third question is, if a black soldier went to war as a manservant, will we find that servant in the United States culture records or with the white soldiers' records?
It depends. Each white regiment was allowed two black undercooks. Now, they were considered soldiers. They were paid the same as the soldiers. And they would be in whatever white regiment they were in. So it's possible that even if your relative was colored, that he might be in a white regiment.
You're referring to a white Union regiment, is that correct?
Right. Now, there were also slaves that went with their masters into the Confederacy,
right,
but they were not enlisted. They were not soldiers. They were not paid. They did not get a pension. Now, it may have been that when the big battle came up, the master may have said, I'm not really feeling very well today. Would you go out and take my place, you know? And he might have carried the gun, and he might have got shot, and he might have got killed, or he might have got wounded, or he might have got captured, but he wasn't a soldier. And about 80,000 are believed to have been along with their masters in the Confederacy.
I know in my own family, with the four soldiers in the Bass family, in soldiers, their youngest brother was, in fact, a younger master, and he, of course, was never considered a soldier in any kind of way. And so you're correct. And, you know, he served his Confederate master on the battlefront, but he was never a soldier. The Uncle Cephas and Braxton and Henry,
right,
and Emmanuel, soldiers.
Now,
one of the
things that might be in particular interest to you is that I have more prisoners of war from Giles County, Tennessee, by far, than from any other place in the country.
Wow. And that's the very regiment that my ancestors were in.
Right.
And,
but I mean, other regiments up and down in that area, there's just an enormous amount. There's probably 500 men that were from Giles County, Tennessee, that are in my database.
Wow, that's
amazing. Yeah, it is amazing. I feel like going to Giles County, Tennessee, and saying, what's the deal here? Why did so many of these guys
enlist?
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Well, I think there was opportunity, particularly.
Tennessee was more apt to be a Union regiment than a lot of the other ones.
Mm-hmm. And I know the 111th and 110th were formed out of North Alabama African descent units.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Fascinating history, though.
Yep.
That's absolutely amazing. Well, we're getting close, I know, out of time. I know Natan is probably going to announce things that are coming up, but are there some, I guess, words that you want to give as advice to our listeners who maybe think that they have an ancestor who may have been imprisoned, and words of encouragement or final words that you would want to share with our listeners?
Well, I think that no matter what research you're doing, a lot of times you'll get a little piece here and a little piece there and a little piece there, but I think if you keep plugging away, and it's kind of like a puzzle. You keep finding a little bit here and a little bit here, and then all of a sudden it comes together and you go, oh, you know. So I would just say, you know, keep on going. Try, if one place you don't find the information, go somewhere else, and I'd be happy to correspond by email with anybody that thinks they might have somebody that's on this list or want to know if somebody's on this list or whatever. And I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now, is you have a current website that would be BobOConnor.com or BobOConnorBooks.com?
Yes. Yeah, that's my website.
Is there information even at the present time that people can go and take a look at to kind of see what you're doing, or are you blogging or some other place? Because I think more people should be aware of your work, and hopefully more of our listeners will be able to follow you.
Right.
Are you present on social media, Facebook, Twitter, anything like that?
I have a Facebook account called Bob O'Connor Journalist.
Okay.
And
okay.
One that's called Bob O'Connor Books. And so I post a lot of things about my research and everything on both of those.
We can follow you there then.
Right.
Okay.
My website mostly has my books. It doesn't have a lot about my research, but okay. I need to probably add that to my website as I go along too. It'll be a separate website that has the database on it. And we're working out the technicalities on that because I'm not very technically minded. And the American Public University in town here is helping me change my database from Excel to Access. And then the West Virginia Humanities Council is giving me some support to aid in my research and some of my travels too. So that's been very helpful to me.
Fantastic. Wow. Well, Bob O'Connor, this has been a real pleasure. I'm following you myself in terms of watching out to see what new data you have to share with us. It has been a pleasure to have you as a guest this evening on Research at the National Archives and Beyond. Thank you so very much. And I guess we're anxious for you to just produce as much as you can, and we'll be all reading your work.
Thank you
so much for being our guest.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, Natan, back
you,
to you.
Thank you, Angela, and thank you, Bob, once again. Our listeners and chatters, you don't want to miss next week's show. The guest is Lieutenant Commander Michael Nolden Henderson, United States Navy retired, author of Got Proof, My Genealogical Journey Through the Use of Documentation. Revealing original documents from as far back as 1770s, Mr. Henderson uses his own experiences as a family history searcher, as well as the insight of noted scholars, to reveal the methods, standards, and techniques used to prove his ancestry. Good night, everyone, and remember, your ancestors left footprints, therefore you should follow the clues that are presented to you through oral history, family records, research at the National Archives and beyond. You can continue this discussion on Afrogenius.com and the Research at the National Archives and Beyond Facebook page. Don't forget to listen to the African Roots podcast with our special guest for tonight, Angela Walton-Raji, on Friday morning. And remember to join Nurturing Our Roots with Antoinette Harrell on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Thank you once again for joining Research at the National Archives and Beyond. Good night, and we look forward to you joining the show next week. Good night, Angela. Good night, Bob.
Good night.
Good night.